Introduction. Something is going wrong with Christianity. In the Western world, it's not hard to make the case that something's gone terminally wrong. People are abandoning churches in their droves, or more commonly, simply steering clear of the services that nourished their forebears. In spite of sustained attempts to reverse the decline, and notable exceptions to the rule, nothing seems able to stop it. This book is a response to the crisis, though it differs from others. It focuses on the inward aspects of Christianity's troubles. It approaches the problem at a felt or mystical level. The root issue, I believe, lies with how Christianity has come to be presented, or to be more precise, how religious Christians have come to misunderstand the message. What was once experienced as a pathway to more life has, today, morphed into a way of life that to outsiders seems self-evidently deluded, defensive, or distorted. The almost limitless capacities of the human soul, which in the past have been articulated and explored by Christianity's key exponents, as they have by the adepts of other traditions, have been largely forgotten by Christians today, and sometimes actively rejected. The upshot is that the working assumption of many Western people is that Christianity will curtail your options, not expand your life, let alone affirm the truth about yourself. The people whom sociologists call spiritual but not religious and knowns shrink from it. It's tragic, and in my view, most Christian apologetics haven't really understood the nature of the problem. It's why more evangelical writers try to sell or prove, not learn and grow. It's why more liberal writers tend to cut Christianity back, feeling they must conform to, not test, contemporary secular assumptions. Both wings whittle away the secret sense of life to which the historical Jesus was clearly supremely alert. By secret, I don't mean a Dan Brownish reference to an occult code, let alone a conspiracy theory, but to a truth that seems obscure or hidden only because it's tricky to grasp. It's secret in the sense of being hard to see, even when plainly spelt out. It's secret in the way that a buried hoard is secret, though is in truth simply resting beneath your feet, waiting to be found. It's a perception that could be known like the quiet constancy of your breath. It's that your life springs from God's life, and that this truth is yours to be discovered. It can be known directly, not on the basis of someone else's report, someone else's authority, someone else's rhetoric, but inwardly and reliably, though it's the work of a lifetime fully to align with it. This is, in fact, standard mystical theology. It follows from the discernment that God is not another being, like you and me, but is the ground of being itself. God is known implicitly as the poetry in the poem, the fire in the equations, the life in the living, the pulse of the cosmos. And it's a truth that must be inhabited to be understood. The situation has become critical for Christianity because over the last 400 or 500 years, churches have been losing touch with this inner element, which is crucial for any path that would call itself spiritual. That's happened for various reasons: the rise of science, the impact of the Reformation, the separation of psychology from spirituality. Nonetheless, it is possible to rediscover, like the goodly pearl of great value, it's waiting to be uncovered. I was lucky enough to find a guide in this task. He's the Oxford Inkling, Owen Barfield. He's sometimes known as the Last Inkling because he was the last of the celebrated group to die in 1997. A close friend of C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien, they both thought he had the most penetrating ideas. However, he wasn't as good a writer, particularly when it comes to blockbuster fiction, and so is not nearly so well known. That said, his core idea is readily understood and radical. He has an account of our spiritual predicament that is illuminating. It arose from a discovery. Barfield realized that the human experience of life shifts fundamentally over periods of cultural time. Our awareness of things evolves. Our consciousness changes dramatically across history. He proposed that it happens in three phases. The first he called original participation, the word participation referring to the felt experience of participating in life. Original participation dominates when there is little distinction between what's felt to be inside someone and what's outside, because the boundaries of individual self-consciousness, which today we take for granted, are not in place. Life is therefore lived at the level of the collective. It's experienced as a continuous flow of vitality between what is me and not me, between mortals and immortals, between past and present, and also between other creatures and the human creature. The inner life of the cosmos is the inner life of the people. Early man did not observe nature in our detached way, Barfield writes. He participated mentally and physically in her inner and outer processes. It determined life in ancient times and can sometimes be glimpsed today. It's in the waves of emotion that sweep across a crowd, as then there's a temporary dissolution of the boundaries between the individual and others. It's an experience that's akin to stepping back in time. A second phase, away from original participation, is marked by what he called a withdrawal of participation. It happens when there's a shift from the sense of being immersed in the life of others, nature and the gods. An awareness of separation, even isolation, is felt. A person will begin to sense that they have an inner life that is, relatively speaking, their own. Barfield argued that a momentous withdrawal of participation began to unfold in the middle of the first millennium BCE. It's the period during which quasi-scientific ideas about the cosmos began to be formed. Some humans turned away from an exclusive reliance on myths as their interests changed from sharing in life to explaining life. Questions such as the meaning of life started to appear, because meaning no longer spontaneously revealed itself to such inquirers. It was a troubling time, though with the withdrawal of participation came an astonishing gain. The concentration of inner life that the separation from outer life brought came hand in hand with an intensification of the sense of being an individual, and with that came all manner of novel possibilities. Moral responsibility emerged, as did new relationships with deities. In the West, this moment is identified with the birth of philosophy in ancient Greece and the emergence of new religious imperatives from the Hebrew prophets. I'm going to focus on these developments from a Western perspective, though a comparative story could be told of the East. It's a time of awakening and rebirth, and results in what Barfield called reciprocal participation, a third phase. Now, the inner life of the individual is felt to belong to him or herself, the gain of the withdrawal, but also to reflect the inner life of nature, the cosmos, and of God. The individual has a soul that is not cut off, an interiority that can reflect and reflect on life and its meaning. People of this age have a subjectivity that can forge purposes and intentions. The awareness of participating in life still involves shared rites and ceremonies, but ideally these will be undertaken freely and consensually, not simply because a priest or king demands it. Inwardness, as we know it, is born. Barfield's three-stage account of the evolution of consciousness is akin to what is also called the axial age, or, as I think is more accurate, times through which axial shifts can be observed developing. This way of putting it was formulated by the German philosopher Karl Jaspers. Original participation is also related to what the French ethologist Lucien Lévy-Bruhl called participation mystique. Axial shifts occur when people evolve, not in the usual Darwinian sense, but culturally, socioeconomically, religiously, and fundamentally existentially, in terms of their sense of themselves. It's a psychological transformation. Where Barfield differs from axial approaches to history is that he argued these changes haven't stopped. The stages are not linear, but cyclical. In fact, about 500 years ago, Western civilization embarked upon another protracted period of withdrawal. Called the Enlightenment, It has embedded the mentality of modern science, and, as with previous periods of withdrawal, the developments it made possible have brought novelties. One was caught by the philosopher Immanuel Kant in a famous essay on the essence of this enlightenment. "Dare to know," he declared, to be the clarion call for the scientific age. However, this daring has led to many troubles taking hold of the Western soul. A key one is the so-called death of God, the widespread sense that, in truth, we may be drifting through empty, meaningless space, both literally across the cosmos and metaphorically in our minds. It's the predicament with which Christianity now wrestles, as do other wisdom traditions, and Barfield's analysis and its application show a way that this might be more skillfully done. The aim of my secret history is to show how, through imaginatively engaging with him, as well as testing his ideas against the findings of recent scholarship, he offers an invaluable diagnosis of the malaise of our times, and further, how the latest withdrawal may actually be part of a The aim of my secret history is to show how, through imaginatively engaging with him, as well as testing his ideas against the findings of recent scholarship, he offers an invaluable diagnosis of the malaise of our times, and further, how the latest withdrawal may actually be part of a divine process that can still be progressed. I believe his insights can help make sense of Christianity, not only to those who faithfully, if somewhat uncertainly, still go to church, but also, potentially, to the many who increasingly recoil from it. Barfield made his discovery about the evolution of consciousness through the study of words. Philology showed him how words change meaning over time and can be treated, therefore, as fossils of consciousness. They record how minds experience life differently in previous periods, such as the fossils of shells and bones record how bodies worked differently in previous periods. An example is illuminating. Consider the words wind and spirit. It turns out that in ancient Greek, as in many other old languages, there is a single word that means both wind and spirit. It's pneuma in Greek, and it's a relic from previous times. It's a linguistic fossil from the undifferentiated consciousness of original participation, because back then, the material world mingled with the immaterial, outer with inner, mortal with immortal, wind with spirit. One word captured what we now think of as two distinct things. It's why, today, verses like John 3:8, "The pneuma blows where it wishes," are almost impossible to translate. More broadly, consider the Bible as a whole. It reflects the same change from the early phase of original participation, because its many words have arisen from human experiences that stretch across more than 1,000 years of evolution. It is, on this reading, a fascinating assembly of consciousness fossils, and an analysis of them supports Barfield's conjecture. It shows that the New Testament is markedly more concerned with introspection than the Old Testament, as would be expected, because the New Testament was written many hundreds of years after original participation and after, therefore, the emergence of a relatively autonomous inner life. Further, the words used by Augustine, 300 years after the New Testament was written, are significantly more introspective again, because by then a phase of reciprocal participation had thoroughly bedded down. In other words, the Bible and the writings of other early Christian authors carry the imprint of the shifts of consciousness that Barfield identified. He wasn't the first to notice it. Thinkers as diverse as the British utilitarian Jeremy Bentham and the American transcendentalist Ralph Waldo Emerson had done so before. Where he differed is in arguing that Christianity played a pivotal role in the development of human awareness. It has been so central to life in the Western world because the life of Jesus captured a crucial juncture in it. Jesus can be said to have understood that the evolution of consciousness had reached a decisive moment. He embodied this moment in his life and worked it out to the full, and thereby became a forerunner that others learnt to follow. He launched the period of reciprocal participation that ran from the first millennium CE until the end of the Middle Ages. The heart of what he showed is the mystical truth, the secret. Individuals are free to know in themselves that their life and God's life is one life. It became possible to awaken to this sense of things because of what had been unfolding in the centuries prior to Jesus' time. In both the Jewish and the Greek worlds, the spiritual geniuses of the first millennium BCE had seen that the way in which people participated in life was shifting. It meant that, whereas in the periods captured by the earlier stories of the Bible and the early myths of the Greeks, people experienced themselves as members of tribes and city-states, living under the influence of the local gods and deities, by the time of the Hebrew prophets and the Greek philosophers, some were seizing hold of another experience. They awoke to an interiority that had a life of its own. They also began to develop different perceptions of the divine. I'll track this process in the first four chapters. It has relevance not only as history, but as the backdrop for our perceptions and participation. The unfolding did not stop there. The prophets and sages began to feel that the full implications of these subtle shifts had to be incarnated. To be wholly realized, the insight of the cosmos needed to be manifested not just in the ideas of perceptive teachers, but in the life of an individual. Only then could the process of separating out the inner life of human beings from the inner life of nature turn like a tide and become a process of reconnecting human minds with the world and the divine. This individual could demonstrate that what comes into a person from outside cannot fundamentally affect them anymore, but instead what matters is what dwells in their hearts and so comes out in their lives. He or she would need to project a felt sense of what it is to possess a mind that knows of a kingdom of infinite space, not only above, but also within. Such an individual would need not to teach others, but show them by embodying it. They would be a revelation of how someone can be fully human and fully transparent to God. In his life, Jesus became such a central figure in the West, the individual around whom is marked nothing less than the turn of the millennia, because his life was this revelation. He crystallized such a perception of what it means to be human, the perception with the potential for a consciousness of individuality as made in the image of God. Chapters 5 and 6 unpack this understanding of Jesus and examine his teaching, life practices, death, and resurrection through this lens. It's not an exclusive account, his life will always exceed any one telling, but it is different from what is commonly heard in churches, at least in my experience. It's not about how Jesus saves, to cite the trite formulation of our times that I believe puts so many people off, but rather is about how Jesus initiates a way that can become our own. It's about how Jesus invited his followers to take up their cross and work out their own salvation so that they too might know the mystery of life in all its fullness. The next chapter explores how this was known in the medieval period, and then finally we come to how consciousness evolved again into the modern period. It is marked by a second major withdrawal from a felt connection with nature and the divine. It's produced the gains of science and technology and a further valuing of the individual. But it's also led to the problems of our age. So in the last chapter, I come to what this way of looking at things can mean for us. At heart, it is that we can develop the skills of the mystics once more and actively align to a level of life that was appealing, even obvious to our ancestors, and can become so again. We can gain a form of reciprocal participation right for our times. New sight emerges across the course of time, Barfield argued. Our awareness of life changes. This development is painful, though the struggle often reveals gifts. It shatters limited horizons. It enables us imaginatively to perceive the vitality of divine reality afresh, and once more participate in it.